It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
I am beyond honored and excited for a president who will fight against Western imperialism and fight for a just world. And I am excited for President Bernie Sanders.
That's the voice of Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, a Somali immigrant who serves in Congress from the state of Minnesota since 2018. And she's very excited to be the co-chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign in Minnesota. What would Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders have in common, you might ask? And we're going to talk about that, among other things, today. But just to kind of remind you a little bit more about who Ilhan Omar is, I think one of her most famous statements happened in this past year. Let's listen.
CARE was founded after 9/11 because they recognized that some people did something and that all of us were starting to lose access to our civil liberties.
So there you go. Ilhan Omar, some people did something on 9/11. Ilhan is anti-Semitic. She is a lot of things. Anti-American, you could say. I just want to give you an idea. But Ben Weingarten, our next guest, has written a book about Ilhan. It just came out. It's called American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. Ben is a senior fellow for the London Center for Policy Research. He's also a fellow at the Claremont Institute and a senior contributor to The Federalist. He lives in New York City. And so I think that that last statement we played of Ilhan must have been particularly stinging. Ben, thanks for joining us this morning.
Sandy, thanks so much for that kind introduction. And I have to say, just hearing those words really makes the hair on your skin crawl.
It really does, even the way she says it. And also then I could not escape, you know, when she was so excited about supporting Bernie Sanders, her talk about taking down Western imperialism. Those buzzwords make the back of my neck, the hair stand up. And I'm sure after we have our conversation today about just who Ilhan Omar is and why she is so dangerous, people will understand that. Let's start with this, Ben. Why in the world would Ilhan Omar be such a great choice, or why would he think she's a great choice, for his co-chair in his presidential campaign in Minnesota? What's the link between them?
Yeah, and first, we should even preface that by mentioning that Minnesota is a pivotal state in 2020 that the Trump campaign believes it can flip. And so Bernie Sanders, the present Democratic frontrunner, in putting Ilhan Omar as the co-chair for that state, really indicates how significant a player he thinks that this radical, anti-American, as you mentioned, blame America first, Congresswoman really is. And what the elevation of Ilhan Omar as a surrogate, and as well, by the way, Keith Ellison, the other co-chair of the Minnesota campaign for Senator Sanders, in addition to Linda Sarsour and the various other radical anti-American Islamist, or at least Islamist sympathizing members of the progressive movement, what that indicates is the unholy progressive Islamist alliance that is at the core of American Ingrate, and that I believe Ilhan Omar herself perfectly personifies. But she's not just a symbolic representative of this sort of unholy alliance, and we can get into where that alliance actually comes from and what they align on in this sort of intersectionalist movement. But she is no substantive, real, serious player in her own right. And that should scare every American for reasons that I'm sure we'll go into.
Yeah, and I think that you, what you're, to say it a different way, yes, she's young, and yes, who is she to us? We just heard about her first when she ran for Congress, but she has been groomed for a very long time to do what she's doing, and been part of what you talk about in your book is her past, her upbringing in Somali. And I let's talk about that first, because that really, to me, makes the intersection between her and Bernie a lot clearer. I just, by the way, just so you know, we just did an entire show on the communist leftist background of Bernie Sanders and also Pete Buttigieg. And so my listeners are aware that Sanders is a Trotskyite, and they're aware that Buttigieg's father was a Russian, also that Pete Buttigieg is a red diaper baby. So, all right, so what about this Somalian known as Ilhan Omar? What is her background in Somali?
Yeah, this is really not discussed enough. And in the book, I go into as great length as one can, because there's so little sourcing about her background, curiously, and so few of the press folks that fawn over her have actually done any digging or scrutinized this background. But what's pivotal to know about Ilhan Omar is that she says that her father and her grandfather were essentially her great political influences in life. Now, why is that significant? Well, first of all, Ilhan Omar grew up in Somalia as a child in pre-Civil War Somalia. What was the country at that time? It was a Marxist-Islamist dictatorship. And that's not Ben Weingarten talking. That's how the New York Times, writing in 1977, as I write in the book, describes the regime under Siad Barre. He was a military dictator who took over Somalia in a coup and ruled the country with Soviet backing up into the Reagan years. So this was a Marxist-Islamist dictatorship, and Ilhan Omar, by her own admission, grew up privileged in that dictatorship. She lived in a compound. She had staff and care helpers, essentially, serving her family. She talks about having ample food such that her family could provide the beggars around her compound with meals. And she describes this sort of paradise-like childhood that she had, filled with books and artwork and a solid education. And what's really interesting is, first of all, talk about the 1% or the 0.1%. In communist Islamist dictatorships, if you're living high on the hog like this, you're from a family that clearly is looked upon favorably from the regime and serves that regime loyally. Otherwise, you would not be living like that. And the reason we sort of know that her family was viewed positively by the regime is that her grandfather is said to have been the director of marine transports in the Somali government. And her father is cited as being a teacher trainer, and she claims she was raised by a family of educators. But what does it mean to be a teacher in a Marxist-Islamic dictatorship backed by the Soviet Union? Well, the press accounts from the time her father and other relatives would have been serving as educators indicate that they would have been educated in Marxism by Soviet authorities. And so if you were a teacher trainer, then you must have been really well educated in Marxism by the Soviet authorities, because your job was to indoctrinate others in that ideology. And again, they must have served the regime quite faithfully to have lived, and loyally to have lived, in the sort of compound that they did. So Ilhan Omar ultimately has this sort of paradise-like childhood shattered because there's a civil war in Somalia. The ruling regime is trounced out of power, and she flees with her family in what she describes as sort of a remarkable journey, and ends up at a refugee camp in Kenya before ultimately arriving in the United States, sort of at the bottom rung of the ladder towards the American dream. And so one of the things that I think is missed is that one of the reasons I believe she has such ingratitude towards America is that she came from this very highly privileged background. But also, we have to appreciate the radical ideology that she would have been surrounded by and that her family prospered under had to have some serious impact on her belief system. And there's plenty of press reports out there about her childhood to indicate that it did have an impact on her sort of thinking about the world and viewing of America as this Western imperialist occupying colonialist power, with all the sorts of Marxist and Islamist rhetoric that she is tinged with and that she asserts. So it's amazing that that background has not really been discussed, and I go into great depth in it in the book. But the even more amazing point, and the point that should really scare your listeners and spur them to action, is the fact that she could have just as easily came out of her Minneapolis enclave with the views that she espouses today as from where she grew up in Mogadishu. And that's a very scary thought.
It is a scary thought. Ben, let me just repeat a few points that you just made in a different way. So Ilhan grows up in Somalia, communist Somalia, which is directly influenced by Soviet communism. And her father is referred to as a teacher trainer. Now, it just makes me think of, Bernie Sanders, who loves Russia, spent his honeymoon in Moscow, was a Trotskyite. So there must be something in common between the two of them, I would think, in terms of their philosophy. Also, Bernie Sanders brags about Castro, you know, developing literacy programs. And then Sanders himself spends a ton of time talking about the importance of education, free education. And of course, his field organizer in Iowa, I believe it was the one in Iowa, openly said that when Bernie talks about education, he's talking about re-education camps. He's talking about indoctrination, propaganda. He's not talking about reading, writing, and arithmetic. Those are my words. And so there's this theme stressing education, being a teacher, trainer, but they're not talking about teaching people, equipping them to face the world and have a full knowledge of literature and history. They're talking about Marxist indoctrination. That's my personal feeling, and I think that is a very strong link. It has to be between Ilhan Omar and Bernie Sanders. So they go to a refugee camp. What more can you say after that? Give us a little bit more history, if you will, Ben, on her life.
Yeah, and let me just add just one final point to what you just said, which is that they're really trying to create social justice warriors out of school. And to jump ahead a bit in the timeline, when Ilhan Omar is elected as a state representative from her district in Minneapolis, it's comprised largely not only of Somali refugees like herself and her family, but also of students at two different college campuses. And the students were actually really the people who put her over the top in that race. But to go back to the refugee camp in Somalia, her biography, what we can glean from it based upon publicly available information, shows that her family basically went from, again, the lap of luxury in Mogadishu to a Kenyan refugee camp where there was constant threat of violence, people engaged in menial labor to get by, it was disease-ridden, and ultimately she is able to get out of that refugee camp and head originally to Virginia with her father and sister, and then ultimately resettle in Minneapolis. But the amazing thing in her narrative about her past is that she talks about having this grand vision of America with every house with a white picket fence and two cars in the driveway, essentially everyone living in total prosperity. And her description of coming to America is that the streets are filled with garbage. There are homeless people everywhere. People can't afford textbooks for their kids. Her entire narrative, and she's repeated this in any number of speeches, and I will go back for many of them in the book, any number of speeches, is a vision of America that completely fails to live up to her vision. And so what is her response to that? She says that her family encouraged her to organize, keyword, organize to create the kind of social justice America
Ben,
I
have to interrupt you. Let me interrupt you just for a second. The book is called American Ingrate. It's brand new, hot off the press. It's written by Ben Weingarten, and we're just starting. This is an insight into who Ilhan Omar, a really very dangerous figure on the American political scene. And we'll talk more about it when we return. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I came to this country hearing about prosperity and a better tomorrow for everyone, and that's what this country promised. I believed that America would be a place that had the tools necessary for people to reach prosperity, lead a happy life and a healthy life. And shortly after I came here, I realized that that wasn't the case.
Yeah, so it's really sad for Ilhan Omar, who now serves in Congress after having been here, I'm not sure how many years. Ilhan Omar, the Somali immigrant whose father was well established, shall we say, some reason, doing very well, an organizer, an educator in communist Somali. And then she comes to this country and she gets elected to Congress. And you've heard her. She has she's good. I have to tell you, she's very, very good. Well, who is she? What's behind all of this? And why is she so dangerous? Ben Weingarten has just written a new book called American Ingrate, Ilhan Omar and the Progressive Islamist Takeover of the Democratic Party. Ben, I really actually find it stunning that she is so articulate and persuasive. She's cunning. She really and truly is. Does that strike you in the same way?
Absolutely. And in doing research for American Ingrate, I went to her district and spoke with people on the ground, including members of the DFL party there, the Democratic Party, in the Minneapolis Twin Cities area. And why we shouldn't just excuse the radical rhetoric and say, well, this is one of 435 members of the House. How powerful could she really be? Besides the fact that she sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee in spite of her anti-American views, besides the fact that she just put out a battery bill of bills on foreign policy that Obama administration official, National Security Council official Ben Rhodes called the new progressive baseline, and besides the fact that, as you mentioned, she's the co-chair of the Democratic frontrunners campaign in the all-important 2020 state of Minnesota, she is very, very politically shrewd. And you can see that in part because she's become a national and even an international phenomenon. She's under 40 years old, and she's only really been in office for under 40 years in her entire life. But what's amazing, as I noted in going into her district and talking to people there, was that many people don't really have an appreciation for the fact that she won a state representative seat in Minnesota. And the person who she beat was a 44-year incumbent feminist icon in the state. And I actually had a chance to sit down with her and speak with her, and I write a bit about that encounter in the book. But this woman, whose name is Phyllis Kahn, was royalty in the state of Minnesota. And Ilhan Omar was able to triumph over her in part because she ran a grassroots campaign, which not only built itself on the demographic factors of there being a large Somali population in her district that was favorable to Omar, but as I mentioned in our last segment, because she was able to get college students, and there are two college campuses in the Minnesota state representative district that she ran in and won, two college campuses who were her major supporters, the people who pushed her over the top in her campaign, and that she was able to organize college students when college students frequently claim to be very passionate about their positions and don't actually go out and vote, should show you that this is someone who is really skilled, talented, and she animates and she creates inspiration in the progressives where the energy really lies in the Democratic Party. And that's why the squad, who Speaker Pelosi has dismissed as, you know what, just four members of the House, actually has substantially outsized power relative to their numbers. And as I write in the book, and I would suggest, I don't think that we would have ever had an impeachment of President Trump had the squad not entered office. And it's precisely because of not only their sway in representing the power and the progressive base of the Democratic Party, but because the Democratic establishment is really scared that they're all going to end up primaried, just like the congressman did, who was primaried by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the first place.
Ben, we talked about her anti-Americanism, and we started. You talked about a number of times she talks about how disappointed she was. This is not the America she expected, and how bad it is. And I want to read just a few other things that you have in your book that she has said. She says that America was founded by the genocide of indigenous people and on the backs of slaves, and ignorance is really pervasive among Americans today. She says Americans must dismantle capitalism and demilitarize U.S. foreign policy, which she sees from the perspective of a foreigner, tweeting, quote, thousands of Somalis were killed by American forces. Hashtag not today, Satan. She also says American support for Israel is all about the Benjamins, baby, and that American Jews disloyally pledge allegiance to Israel's apartheid regime, which has, quote, hypnotized the world. Then, of course, we already played the clip where she said on 9/11, some people did something. Yeah, so there's anti-Americanism and then there's anti-Semitism. Ben, kind of explore that beyond those quotes. Is she anti-Semitic? Is she anti-American?
Yeah, she, based upon her rhetoric and the policies that she supports, starting with her support of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, which, as I go into great detail in the book, is a terror-tied movement that ultimately seeks the destruction of Israel. And so how can a movement that seeks the destruction of Israel claim to not be a movement built on hatred of Jews? She checks every single box in terms of the U.S. government Jews definition of anti-Semitism and Jew hatred, the internationally recognized definitions of Jew hatred. She checks off every box. But what I argue in the book is that anti-Semitism masquerading as being anti-Israel or anti-Zionism, first of all, that Jew hatred is the glue that holds the progressive Islamist alliance together. And I go into the history of both leftism and the Islamic world to show the linkage between the two and how they've worked together to try to triumph with their totalitarian and expansionist movements based upon, in part, what unifies them in that Jew hatred. But the Jew hatred is really a stand-in for hatred of Judeo-Christian Western civilization. It's using Jews as the representative of our civilization and the collective Jew represented by the State of Israel to represent hatred of Judeo-Christian Western civilization itself. And you have to ask the question, why? And what you see in her rhetoric is a view that's common among both leftists and Islamists that America is an evil, oppressive, colonialist, occupying, genocidal, irredeemable, deplorable place. And if that's your view of America, then obviously the only moral, just, righteous thing to do is to hate America and to seek to overthrow its core founding values, principles, and institutions. So from their perspective, hatred of America is considered the most virtuous, the most just, the most moral, the good thing to do at core. And that is how they justify this completely radical anti-American agenda. But again, I just want to emphasize that the hatred of Israel and hatred of Jews that's reflected in her rhetoric, her policies, her actions, and her associations that I write in great detail in the book about her associations with all manner of anti-American, Islamist, terror-tied figures and regimes and organizations. But at the end of the day, it is really about us, Judeo-Christian Western civilization. And the reason is because Judeo-Christian Western civilization is what stands between a progressive or Islam-dominated world. And both of those movements are totalitarian in nature. Again, they agree on their Jew hatred as a core element of it. But ultimately, they seek to triumph. They cannot allow any dissent. And the big stumbling block for either of them dominating here or abroad is us, is Judeo-Christian Western civilization. And that's where the hatred stems from. And that is also what ties them together.
Ben, I guess it's kind of like that old adage, the enemy of my enemies is my friend. Because in many ways, as we both know, the left, the communist left or the left, whatever moniker you want to use, has very little in common with Islam. We see kind of the strife and the Uyghurs. It's the Uyghurs. It's the Islamic Chinese. They don't fit in well in China, so they're having trouble. We see in its communist country. We see in Russia they're having trouble with their Islamist element. So there is a basic disagreement and strife and hatred between them. But as you said, the thing that unites them together is that they are both enemies of the Judeo-Christian foundation and ethics of the United States. So they do. But at some point, Ben, they're going to have to separate. Let's say they succeed in taking out right now would be Donald Trump's presidency, but it'll take other forms in the future. Let's suppose they succeed in undermining this country. Then what happens next? They're going to turn on each other, are they not?
Absolutely. As vicious as they would treat us, they would be even more vicious when it came to a battle between each other. But as you said, it's a simple matter of prudence and practicality for them, cold, calculating, and rational, that the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that is the way that the alliance works today. And incidentally, you even see this in terms of Omar's position on the Middle East, where she sides with Iran, she sides with Iran's partner, Turkey. And I had an op-ed in the New York Post about Ilhan Omar's collusion with Turkey's Islamists that I urge your listeners to check out. And she sides against, on the other hand, Israel and our Sunni Arab partners and Israel's Sunni Arab partners who stand against Iran and the Turks and several other forces in the region as well. So it's very clear, you know, it's not as if the Sunni Arab states have ever historically been friends with Israel. In fact, they wanted to triumph over Israel and destroy Israel, just like the Iranian malocracy does today. However, for practical reasons, they stand together. But Ilhan Omar, for her own practical reasons, stands with the Iranians and the Turks, and as do many members of the Democratic Party today. And almost every Democratic presidential candidate has said they would like to re-enter an Iran nuclear deal, which provided a massive, more than $100 billion lifeline to that malocracy and legitimized the malocracy's nuclear program and its ballistic weapons programs. So you see this playing out in real time in concrete terms. It goes beyond just their ideologies, but it goes into what their policies are. And ultimately, those policies are disastrous for the life and limb of the American people and our allies and partners.
Actually, just a practical example you just alluded to, but let's talk about it for a second. The Erdogan, who is the president of Turkey, is an Islamist. He is. He sort of held that back for a long time, and now it's become more and more apparent. He is not an ally. Turkey used to be a strong ally, but he's a dangerous man. And yet Ilhan Omar has this, I believe, Ben, this private meeting with him. And with a person with no more stature than she has, what was that all about? Do we know?
Yeah, it is really remarkable. And this actually was sort of the genesis of American Ingrid, the book itself, which is, why is Erdogan meeting with this state representative from Minnesota? And it took me down a path where I comprehensively analyzed Ilhan Omar's collusion with Islamists, foreign and domestic, which I think is the real story, the real important story in an era where we're obsessed with foreign interference and foreign collusion. Well, here's a perfect example of it that no one is talking about. And I go into great depth in the book to explore it. But the meeting, based upon the few press reports that exist, and some of them are foreign language press reports, basically shows that they talk about Turkey-Somali relations. Now, what is a state representative from Minnesota doing talking with the head of state of a so-called NATO ally, purported NATO ally, about the foreign relations of Turkey and another country, not America? And during that meeting, it comes out that Erdogan said that they agreed that Omar would basically be a supporter of the Turkish regime. And a month later, or so, Omar was tweeting in support of Turkey for its humanitarian efforts in Somalia. And it bears noting, and bear with me on this, that Turkey and Somalia have extensive bilateral relations. Turkey may be the most heavily invested partner in Somalia for its own strategic reasons. So it's very clear that from the start, they believed Ilhan Omar to be an important figure in fostering that relationship. But this is a U.S. state representative. This is not a Somali representative. That alone should give us substantial pause. And then, as I document in the book, and you can see the short form version of it in my New York Post op-ed on this, over the years, Turkish officials have met with Omar on numerous occasions. She has visited Turkey on at least one or two occasions, and she has even received funds from a lobbyist who is purportedly Erdogan's cousin, and that lobbyist was lobbying against a resolution that would have put the blame for the Armenian genocide at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, which is historically accurate. And lo and behold, Ilhan Omar was either the sole or one of only two members of the House not to affirm that resolution, recognizing the Armenian genocide as being perpetrated by the Ottoman Turks. She was also one of the only representatives to vote against sanctions against the Turkish regime for its incursion into Syria, into northern Syria, and its attacks on Kurdish forces. So they've gotten what they've paid for when it comes to Ilhan Omar, and that's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of her collusion with Islamists, often terror-tied Islamists, foreign and domestic.
Yes, and we're going to talk more about that, too, Ben, in a second. The book, by the way, is called American Ingrate. American Ingrate, which just came out last week, actually. And, of course, Ben writes about her past. We're going to get a little bit into that because you've heard about her allegedly marrying her brother. That's a those, I guess, by comparison, are small things. When you think she might actually be a traitor or someone who is standing against the country, working inside the Congress in the intelligence or the Foreign Relations Committee, it's really shocking. Her connections with CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, her support of Somali terrorists. Oh, but wait, there's more. As they say, Ben Weingarten is my guest. We'll be back with more of that in a second on Sandy Rios in the Morning.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the Morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Something that I get criticized for all the time. It's not what you think, so don't, like, don't gasp. It is that, like, I am anti-American because I criticize the United States. And I believe, as an immigrant, I probably love this country more than anyone that is naturally born. And because I am ashamed of it continuing to live in its hypocrisy, that I work so hard to make sure that others who've had that, like, why just be American? Why don't you be more like an American? Can continue to say that. Why can't you be more like an American? Because it used to be a very positive thing. We export American exceptionalism, the great America, the land of liberty and justice. That is, you know, if you ask anybody in walking on the side of the street somewhere in the middle of the world, they will tell you America the Great. But we don't live those values here. And so that hypocrisy is one that I'm bothered by. I want America the Great to be America the Great.
Yes, I'm sure you do, Ilhan Omar. Yeah, Sandy Rios with you. That's amazing. The book is called American Ingrate. It is an expose of Ilhan Omar and the progressive Islamist takeover of the Democratic Party. By the way, Ben's book, he has some great endorsers here. Victor Davis Hanson, one of my favorites. Dennis Prager, Newt Gingrich, and also Caroline Glick, who used to write for the Jerusalem Post. I love Caroline's writing. And also a foreword by Andy McCarthy. And if I would, just for a second, Ben, I want to write a little bit about what Andy says. Andy is an expert. He was the prosecutor of the first World Trade Center bombing. He's been on the show many, many times. Andy is one of the nation's leading experts on political Islam, we'll call it that. And he says in his foreword to Ben's book that Ms. Omar is not a jihadist. Stay tuned, though. Islamists' adherence to political Islam, a confusing term since classical Islam does not separate mosque and state, are best understood as Sharia supremacists. This term underscores their objective. The most effective Islamists are not the jihadists, although they are adept at exploiting the atmosphere of intimidation the jihadists create. The Muslim Brotherhood, the world's most influential and successful global Sharia supremacist movement, has always regarded violence as just one item on an ideologically aggressive menu. The Brotherhood has always thrived on the campus, has always been educated, disciplined, and savvy. It prefers to infiltrate the institutions of influence, government, law, media, and the academy. These sophisticated Islamists have always grasped that to succeed in the West, a long-term incrementalist strategy would be necessary. The strategy would convert the West's liberties, free speech, association, political participation, religious observance, access to the courts, into its own arsenal. To succeed, it requires alliances, and none have been more valuable than the anti-Western left. And that makes Ben's point in the foreword by Andy McCarthy that Ilhan Omar is the personification of that alliance between the red-green axis, as you would have it, the red communist left and the Islamist, whatever you want to call them. Ben, that makes your point, it makes it a little clearer as to why the colleges in Minnesota really, you said, pushed Ilhan over the mark. And I guess we could fill in the blank there and just talk about why colleges and universities would be so excited about Ilhan Omar.
Yeah, it really, and this sort of goes back, you know, to the century-long, essentially, long march through the institution. You mentioned Pete Buttigieg and his father, who is the foremost expert on Antonio Gramsci, who was the ideologue leftist who came up with the idea of the need to take over all of our institutions in order to impact culture and then to effectuate the radical political ends, the revolutionary political ends that they sought. I've long thought of our academic institutions, and in particular, our higher academic institutions, and even more particularly, our elite higher academic institutions, as being indoctrination grounds that are devoted to creating social justice warriors, not to creating critical thinkers who will be productive and contribute to their society. And certainly a love of America, understanding of civics, and a proper understanding of our history. That is exactly the opposite of what is taught at many of our leading institutions. So if your belief is that to love the country or to show your love for country, you have to hate it. Well, when it comes to your nation, you don't hate you don't hurt the ones that you love. And like in that audio clip you played of Ilhan Omar, she believes explicitly you should hate the ones that you love. And for our worst adversaries, she provides a hug to all of them. So she talks about hypocrisy. What about Ilhan Omar's hypocrisy in cozying up to Erdogan or the Iranian regime or any of a number of horrible regimes around the world while trashing America, trashing Israel, and by the way, also showing great love for her native Somalia, which is a corrupt, tyrannical Islamist dictatorship. So, you know, how does that fit in with our schools? Well, she is the perfect product of what would come out of American schools for those who believe in that sort of long march through the institutions mentality and the radical overthrow of our institutions.
And the other problem is the same problem we have repeatedly, Ben, and that the media, anytime there's much criticism about Ilhan, it's always, you know, it's racism. I'm not sure any other outlet has really covered her except for Fox, and probably not to the extent they should have. What do we know? What can we say? What did you find out about her marital status? We've heard that she actually married her brother. We've heard that she's not paid her taxes. We've heard that she's been living with her political consultant. Did your book cover those kinds of things too?
It does, and it's only one chapter at the end of the book, which I think underscores the fact that that alone is scandalous and should merit her. It's so compromising, the familial issues, the fact that she did jointly file for taxes when she was not married to the person who she jointly filed with by law. That's documented and a fact, and she's had numerous ethics violations in Minnesota. Again, documented. That's factual. It's just the tip of the iceberg in terms of her personally compromising behavior and also essentially the disrespect that she's showing for our laws, which goes with her ingratitude towards the country and disrespect for the country. So it's all of a piece with the broader thesis of the book and the idea that she is an American ingrate. What we document in the book, and there have been a few people who have done amazing work on this in spite of the fact that it's been subject to vicious attacks, including Scott Johnson at Powerline and David Steinberg, who was at PJ Media, and Preya Samsunder at Alpha News. And I'm only emphasizing this because they really deserve substantial credit for pushing the ball on this story forward. It does appear that she's certainly engaged in marriage fraud based upon the evidence out there. And it is likely that she engaged in marriage fraud with her brother. And this is backed up by the fact that she was living with this person who she married under U.S. law. At the same time, it appears she shared an address with the person who she had been with for 8 years prior to that time and had two children with. It's also reflected in social media postings where she claimed in divorce proceedings that she had never had contact with this person, didn't know where he was at a certain date, and there's social media indicating that she did actually have substantial contact with this person after that date. There's a picture of this person who she was married to under U.S. law after the date that I mentioned, holding what appears to be Ilhan Omar's newborn daughter, dated the day after that daughter would have been born. So there's and referring to that daughter as his niece. So it's very clear there's substantial evidence out there to support this. And the motive is basically that this man was a foreign national. Ilhan Omar marries him, comes over to the U.S. They both get a college education at the same campus, North Dakota State University. They're living together, and it appears with Ilhan Omar's prior boyfriend and the father of her two children during that time. And she fights this. I should say that after 2 years, he leaves the U.S., and Ilhan Omar gets right back with the father of her two children and has a third child, and stays with him then for a number of years after until their recent divorce, in part, it seems, over the affair that you mentioned that she had with a political consultant. It's all a very twisted web that was weaved, but all you need to know about it is Ilhan Omar won't answer questions about it. All of the social media evidence has been deleted, and anyone that dares to pursue it is attacked mercilessly, but it does appear that at least one or several federal agencies are looking into this. I'm not confident or optimistic that it's going to end up anywhere, but the evidence out there is damning enough. I chronicle it in great detail in the book, and what should really scare us is that any one of the points that I've made here alone would make it almost impossible for her to get even the most basic level of a security clearance. Yet, as you noted, this is someone who sits on the House Foreign Affairs Committee with access to the most sensitive, dangerous national security information that there is. And when you add that to her extensive ties to Islamists, foreign and domestic, including the unindicted co-conspirator in the largest terrorist financing case in American history, at least to that point, in Hamas-tied care, we have a real problem on our hands. It poses a real threat. She'd be compromisable enough with her personal behavior if you're looking at it from the perspective of a foreign adversary. But then you said you add that she's friends with all of these adversaries, foreign and domestic, and really creates a danger that should chill every American.
Is there any, in her upcoming election, is there any real challenge? I mean, she's coming from a Somali community in Minnesota, I think her district, and I wonder if there is any serious challenger who could actually take her seat. Do you know, Ben?
Yeah, so she has several competitors in her own party primary, and then there are a number of Republicans as well who are vying for the seat, but I must admit I am not bullish on the prospect of any of them. She is treated as royalty, and what's really amazing is that she's alienated her own Somali constituency by her own personal behavior or misbehavior, by some of the positions that she's taken on social issues that through the traditional Muslim Somalis in her district are just completely antithetical to their beliefs. And I would argue that that's probably one of the reasons why we've seen that the biggest whistleblowers on Ilhan Omar's own personal misbehavior are actually Somali American Muslims, patriots, who believe that she poses a threat and wanted to expose her alleged marriage fraud. And one of them has come out on record. Worth noting as well, people in her own community have been threatened, it appears, by those in her own orbit for speaking out about her own personal criminal misbehavior. And there's a raft of criminality associated with that marriage fraud. But back to your main point, I don't think that any of these candidates really pose a threat to her office. And when I was in her district, what I was told by senior people in her own party is that she's basically unbeatable. Maybe Al Franken could have been the only one to primary her. And obviously that's a big step down for a former senator from a state to run for a House seat. And he's not running. So I think it's very clear that, you know, she should be expected to win and win by a large margin. And I hope I'm proven wrong.
Ben Weingarten is my guest, and his new book is called American Ingrate. And of course, if you haven't picked up on it already, it's about Ilhan Omar. So, Ben, what more do we want people to know about her? And is there anything that can be done?
Yeah, so the reason that I wrote this book was to use Ilhan Omar as a window to expose the progressive Islamist nexus that is increasingly becoming the power in the Democratic Party. And if you have a party that represents roughly half the country that is dominated by people who are anti-American, who believe in an agenda of socialism at home and surrender and appeasement abroad, then your country is not going to be long for this world. And that is what is at stake, not just with the Bernie Sanders run, but this is going to last well beyond the Bernie Sanders run. There's a fight for the soul of a Democratic Party that is increasingly dominated by people who are not patriotic, who view hating America as the most patriotic thing one can do. And what I write in the book is that while Ilhan Omar is a disastrous figure in her own right, we would not have Ilhan Omar's were it not for many decisions that took place in America involving our immigration policies, involving our education system. She should have never been able to rise to this position of power. Arguably, she should have never been able to come here in the first place. And so the real fault lies with us. And we need to make a decision as a country as to whether or not we're going to accept this anti-Americanism, this blame America first worldview, to dominate one half of the country. And it's very clear that they're very close, because if you even look at how many Democrats are in the House.
Absolutely. Ben, it's a fabulous book. So much more to say, but we're out of time. It's called American Ingrate. We'll put the link on our Facebook page. Also, Ben's latest article about this book. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.